Assalamu alaikum, peace be unto you. Welcome to another episode of Islam in Focus. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our 44th program in our series, dealing with Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, the last messenger of Islam. Today we have our third program in commenting on the marriages of the Prophet. I'm joined as my guest on today's program by Dr. Jamal Badawi of Sheikh Mirza University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Before we get into today's program, could you very quickly highlight the main points that we touched on in last week's program?
Certainly. We discussed the connection between the marriage of the Prophet to Khadija and his sexual purity, and we indicated with ample reasoning, I hope, that it was not really a pleasure-seeking type of attitude in his marriage to Khadija. Because of the difference in age, he did not marry with any woman alongside with her, even though polygamy was accepted socially and culturally. We discussed also the deep relationship of love and affection that was between them, that he continued to remember her even after her death. And that seemed to indicate the spiritual and psychological companionship as the prominent motive behind their marriage, that this relationship really was a joint struggle to seek the pleasure of God, not their own individual pleasures. We indicated also that after the death of Khadija, his first wife, with whom he lived alone for 25 years, he married Sauda.
Yes.
And Sauda was probably at least 55 years old. Some give an older age even for her. And then even after he married Sauda, she did not move to his household until 2 years later. So that left him with almost 2 or 3 years of period where he didn't have any wife in the household even. We indicated also that information available about Sauda shows that she was not beautiful, in addition to being, of course, old. Neither she was rich, for example, or have any other attraction. And we indicated that the real reason for the Prophet's marriage to Sauda is that her husband died when she was in Ethiopia, when they went because of persecution of Muslims in Mecca. And her family were very much enemies of the Prophet and of Muslims. And as such, the marriage of the Prophet to her was a sort of protection for her. It gave her a home and saved her from any retaliation, possible retaliation by her family. And that led also to the softening of the hearts,
yes,
of her family. And some of them appreciated the nobility of the Prophet, and they actually, many of them, embraced Islam. We also, last time, brought a chart to show, which was to the scale, actually, the various phases in the life of the Prophet. And we indicated that unlike the erroneous impression left by some writers, non-Muslim writers, in fact, the greatest part of his life was a life of chaste bachelorship, that's up to the age of 25, or monogamy with one wife between the age of 25 to 50 with Khadija alone, and practical monogamy really after 1 year or so of widowhood when he was married to Sauda. She moved to his household only 2 years later. And we finally indicated that even before the polygamous period, the last phase in his life, or the last 7 years of his life, that even though he contracted marriage to Aisha, while he was already married to Sauda, Aisha did not move to his household until 3 years after the contract, which means that up to the age of 56, he was in virtual state of monogamy, actually, the major part of his life.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to pick up on the distinction between contracting the marriage and moving to the household of the Prophet. Can I ask you perhaps to clarify the difference between these two phases?
Sure. In Islamic law, it is permissible, actually, if, for example, a person is getting married to someone, that the marriage contract is negotiated and signed and everything, in which case, legally speaking, they become husband and wife. But on the other hand, sometimes also, for whatever reasons, people might not consummate the marriage immediately, and the wife may not necessarily move directly or immediately to the household of the person to whom she got married. So in the case of Aisha, the Prophet was already married to Sauda. So the marital contract was negotiated with the approval of Aisha and her parent. And in fact, the reason she did not probably move directly to his household, one possible reason is that she was too young. The historians differ. Some give the age of 6, some give the age of 9. 9 seems to be the more reasonable one, because by any stretch of imagination, the age of 6, of course, will not be an age really where marriage is contracted. But in any case, this has been the estimates given by some historians. And perhaps in that age, while the marital contract is legitimate, she might have not been ready yet for marital life, and maybe that's why she probably stayed for several more years with her family until she was mature enough to move to the household of the Prophet. I must add also that even moving to the household of the Prophet,
yes,
may not necessarily also mean that the marriage was consummated. So this is a third distinction even between contracting,
yes,
the marriage,
yes,
moving to the household, to be part of the household, yes, and a consummation of marriage.
I'm sure many of the viewers are probably asking or wondering if the age of 12 is not too early for to be contemplating marriage, and also the age difference, the gap between the Prophet and Aisha was quite significant. Would you comment on those two?
Okay, you're referring first to 12 in a sense that if you take the narration that says they were married or negotiated the contract at the age of 9, and I mentioned that she moved to the household 3 years later.
Yes.
So let's say about the age of 12 when she moved to his household. I think this indeed might sound rather strange today in the confines of the Western culture, its laws and customs. There's no question about that. It sounds rather early for marriage. But on the other hand, the sociological and cultural circumstances 1400 years ago in Arabia may not necessarily be the same as we have it today. And we cannot really subject that period in that place with the to the criteria or the measurement that we use in our contemporary society or our particular current customs. To begin with, I don't believe that the difference in age in itself should be a barrier towards marriage, that she was very young and he was already in his mid-50s. That is not in itself a barrier in marriage. In fact, we hear once in a while, also even in the Western society, of marriages with wide difference of age. If there are other good reasons for compatibility or other strong reasons for that marriage, the age difference should not in itself be a barrier, unless, of course, you're talking about something very, very unreasonable, like somebody who's 80 years old marrying 16 years old, for example.
Yes.
That might be a clearer case, but otherwise there's no criteria really to determine one particular age difference. And even if you look at the Western society today, you find that the culture and customs again here seem to be against a marriage of minors,
yes,
even negotiating a contract, even with the approval of the parents. Of course, that's the law of the land. I think in the West, it's mostly about, 16 years old or something of that nature.
18 or 19, yes.
Or 18 or 19 or something like that. But on the other hand, if you look at the matter in the framework of the culture and society of the time when the Prophet contracted the marriage, that was quite common. And even today, I would say, in some other cultures in the East, there are cases of people also contracting marriage to minors, even though they would not move to the household of the husband immediately. As far as the young age, when you talk about 12 or so, 12 or possibly 13, because some give 4 years even before she moved to the household.
Yes.
Even then, from the purely medical standpoint, and this I checked with the physicians, you know, that it is quite possible and not unusual for a girl to be totally mature and
yes,
reach adolescence at the age of 12. It's not unreasonable to expect. And also, I was told that the age of adolescence varies from one family to the other, one person to the other. It also varies with races,
yes,
and the weather. In the warm areas, I was told by one physician, for example, who practiced in India, in Britain, and in North America, that he has seen many cases of an average earlier age of reaching adolescence in the areas in the world where it's it's reasonably more warm.
Yes.
I don't know whether this has anything to do with the hormonal activities. This is something that, you know, can be checked. But on the whole, there is no difficulty at all of marriage and maturity, even as early as 12, mm-hmm. even before sometimes. But the marriage, in any case, with Aisha was essentially the advancement of faith, really, rather than, you know, marrying for pleasure. Because yes. even when you contract a marriage to a child or a minor before reaching the age of adolescence, obviously it's not the physical attraction.
Yes.
And to have to wait for several years before she moves to the household, yes. obviously shows that there must have been other overarching reasons beyond the pleasure itself.
You mentioned that the intent, in your view, behind the marriage was that it was helpful in advancing the faith.
Yes.
Could you explain in what sense that was the case?
Okay, to begin with, as indicated earlier, Muslims were severely persecuted in Mecca. And among the earliest people who became Muslims and accepted the Prophet, there were a number of very devout Muslims, including Abu Bakr. Abu Bakr, in fact, was the first male adult to embrace Islam and to follow the Prophet, and became very much beloved and close to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Abu Bakr was a very strong supporter of the Prophet in the most difficult times, especially in the migration from Mecca to Medina. The Quran makes reference to that in Surah 9, in verse 41. In addition to that, Abu Bakr was a very wise man. He was of very good reputation and good character among his people. And in fact, as we'll see later in history, he was chosen to be the first caliph after the death of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Now, Aisha was the daughter of that man.
Yes.
So Aisha was the daughter of Abu Bakr. So for the Prophet to get married from the daughter of his very close and beloved companion and supporter like Abu Bakr was very useful in honoring Abu Bakr, in establishing a sort of more rapport and cementing the relationship, and in a way rewarding him for his faithfulness also. And marriage, of course, customary, was regarded as one of those important yes. means of cementing relationships. Like I said, we notice in this marriage that Aisha at the time was too young, so the definitely there was no question of romance or attraction. Yes. She was still a child, really, practically. Secondly, that this marriage helped also to demolish and destroy some of the bad customs that existed among Arabs. We find some reference to that actually in Muslim. That apparently the Arabs, whenever somebody was so close to the other and he calls him, "You're my brother,"
yes,
not necessarily blood brother, being a blood brother. If somebody calls himself, called the other, "my brother," that some of them used to believe that he should not get married to his daughter, or else he would be marrying, you know, his
yes, in the family,
his niece, yeah, yes. in the family. Even though it's just the superficial, just the, you know, brotherhood in blood, in faith, not in blood. And apparently that was the case because, according to the narration in Muslim, that when Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, offered to Abu Bakr the request or, you know, proposal to marry his daughter Aisha, Abu Bakr said, "Oh, Messenger of God, but you are my brother." So the Prophet answered, he said, "Yes, you are my brother in faith, but according to the Book of God, she is lawful unto me in terms of marriage." And that actually was to remove that bad habit, because that established artificial barriers in perfectly legitimate marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And made a clear distinction between blood brotherhood and brotherhood in faith, which should not be a barrier in terms of intermarriages. But indeed, this marriage was quite crucial in the advancement of Islam because of the exceedingly important and crucial role played by Aisha. The Prophet made a very, very good choice, and I wouldn't be surprised if that was not even directed through some sort of inspiration, that yes. Aisha was destined to play a very important role in preserving and advancing the faith.
I'd like to have you shed some light on that role that Aisha played and its relationship to her marriage to the Prophet. Could you comment on that further?
Sure. To begin with, Islam is a complete and comprehensive way of living, which involves all aspects of human life on the individual, personal, social, economic, political levels, to begin with. According to the Quran in Surah 33, in passage 21, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is not only sent as just a recorder, somebody who receives the revelation and utter it, just in words, but also to be the embodiment of the teaching of Islam, to be, as the Quran call it in that verse, Uswatun Hasana, the perfect example for us to follow as a human being. And to follow the example of the Prophet means that we need to have more information about all aspects and all phases of his life, including even domestic life at home, or whatever he teaches all the time pertaining to the religious practice of the believers. Well, the best to teach people and tell them about the life of the Prophet as a family man, as a husband and father, obviously would be his wives. But the role of Aisha even was more than that, because other women could have performed that role also, to be the communicators of the practice of the Prophet in his family. Because Aisha indeed was of extraordinary intelligence and memory, and scholarship for that matter, in fact. She was a very important source of Islamic teaching pertaining to the family structure and family life. She was narrator of numerous saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which provide guidance to Muslim and still providing guidance 100 years after her. I'll just give you, you know, to satisfy your question, some examples of what some of the great scholars said about the scholarship and ability of Aisha. Imam Abdullah al-Dhahabi, who is a prominent scholar in the so-called ilm al-rijal, or the science of biography. You see, the Muslim developed also science of biography to verify and authenticate various reports. So he was a specialist in getting information about the people who narrated sayings of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. This Imam al-Dhahabi, in his book called Tazkiratul Huffaz, he describes Aisha as one of the greatest scholars among the companions. Not just the greatest companion or greatest Muslim, one of the greatest of all the scholars, fuqaha, the jurist. And he said that whenever we had any problem that we were confused about or uncertain, we went to Aisha and we always found that she had some knowledge about it.
Yes.
And here when he says we, he's not referring to the common man.
Yes.
He's talking about scholars. That's when the scholars themselves, the jurists, had some issues that they wanted to verify, they always found that Aisha had some knowledge on that. Imam al-Zuhari, another great scholar also, he said that if the knowledge of Aisha was compared to the knowledge of all the mothers of the believers, referring to the other wives of the Prophet, and the knowledge of all women, the knowledge of Aisha would supersede, would become even greater. Another scholar, excuse me, by the name of Ata ibn Rabah, he said that Aisha was the most knowledgeable in terms of fiqh, in understanding Islamic law, and the best in terms of giving opinion to the public. So this definitely reflects the fact that she was a rare talent. This kind of talent could have been easily lost had she married just an ordinary man. But the very fact that she lived as the wife of the Prophet of Islam, she became like a school, really, through her many generations of scholars graduated. We were able to get more information and more in-depth look about the life of the Prophet, and to shed more light about the greatness of the personality of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. She was just a rare person, really.
Right. Were there other instances in the Prophet's marriages to daughters of his close companions where the marriages were carried out to cement the relationships?
You mean beside Abu Bakr?
Besides Abu Bakr.
Yes. Indeed, as it's well known that the second closest person also to the Prophet, more or less, or one of the closest few to the Prophet, inner circle, beside Abu Bakr, is Umar. May peace be upon him. God's pleasure and peace be with him also. Umar also was, even though he embraced Islam at a later time, later than Abu Bakr, was so close to the Prophet to the point that even after the death of the Prophet, he was the second caliph, that's after Abu Bakr. And like Abu Bakr also, Umar was a person with a great deal of virtue. He was a great statesman, and in fact, his life as a caliph is very exemplary in terms of his, you know,
yes,
the sacrifice and living in poverty and looking after the needs of people. So he had lots of very good qualities as a person. What happened is that Umar had a daughter by the name of Hafsa. And Hafsa was married already to a person whose name is Khunais ibn Hudhafa al-Ansari. Like her husband, Hafsa also was very devoted to the cause of Islam and Muslims, and she participated with her husband in defending Muslims in the famous Battle of Badr.
Mm-hmm.
During that battle, her husband was injured, severely injured, and she of course tried to help, as she was helping other wounded Muslims in that battle. And as soon as his wound was just, you know, nursed and she wrapped him, he continued again to fight. But then a number of arrows, you know, cut him apart, really. So he was martyred in that battle. Despite of the grief of Hafsa and seeing her husband really die, she courageously continued in this very pressing battle to nurse other people who were injured, to supply them with water and look after them. Of course, as the battle ended, her grief was really unbearable.
Yes.
So what happened is that Umar wanted to do something for his daughter. So he went first to Abu Bakr to offer him to get married to his daughter, just to look after her. And then so Abu Bakr declined. He went to Uthman, another close companion of the Prophet. Uthman also politely declined. So Umar got a little bit, you know, upset about that, and obviously he was worried about his daughter. Now she's a widow, and probably she was not that attractive that anybody else would marry her, because she was not that young, and the reports about her that she was not particularly beautiful. In fact, some historians say that even after the Prophet married her, she did not particularly love her as much, and she was sometimes a little bit, you know, rough,
yes,
in her treatment of the Prophet, except that she was also very pious. She used to pray and fast a lot, which might have compensated for that. But even one narration says that one time the Prophet even thought of divorcing her, but to honor her and honor Umar, his companion, he did not go through with this. So what happened is that when the Prophet learned about her plight and how Umar was upset that nobody else offered marriage to her, so the Prophet said, all right, somebody better even is going to get married to her. So he took her for wife and actually gave his daughter to Uthman, whose previous wife died before. So that was a way of reconciling the companions and also honoring Hafsa in looking after her after the death of her husband. And this was not necessarily the only widow of someone who was martyred for the cause of Islam that the Prophet offered marriage to.
Could you tell us a bit more about this marriage as well?
Well, after the Prophet's marriage to Hafsa, he also married a woman by the name of Zainab bint Khuzaimah.
Yes.
This was an elderly woman, again, who was known by the nickname of Ummul Masakin, the mother of the destitute, Ummul Masakin. And the reason she was given that name, actually, that she was an elderly and very kind woman, that she used to really love and look after the, you know, people who are orphans and poor. This woman, Zainab bint Khuzaimah, was married to one of the heroes of Islam by the name of Ubaidah ibn al-Harith ibn Abd al-Muttalib. And that hero actually was martyred in the same battle where Hafsa's husband also was martyred in the Battle of Badr. And like Hafsa also, despite of the martyrdom of her husband, Zainab continued to help the Muslims in the battle until God gave them victory over the pagans. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, heard about her courage, sacrifice and, of course, her pains for the loss of her husband, so he offered her marriage. It is said to have been about the age of 60.
Yes.
60 years old, and the Prophet marrying her. What kind of purpose, really, would there be behind that? In fact, she was so old that she died only 2 years after she was married to the Prophet, peace be upon him. The question, again, that should be always repeated, is this marriage for passion or compassion? This was actually a lesson, even, mm-hmm. beyond looking after a one particular woman who was a widow. But it was actually a lesson also for Muslims, like I indicated in a previous program, to look after those people who lost their husbands, to look after the orphans they left in their sacrifice in defending the cause of Islam. And since, again, the Battle of Badr was not the only battle which Muslims had to confront their enemies, we find that both the Prophet as well as his companions did get married of widows of other martyrs of other battles, as is the case of the marriage of the Prophet, for example, between the Prophet and Umm Salama, which is another good reason to believe that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in his marriages really was perhaps gave the most noble example in those marriages.
Mm-hmm. Since we're examining this topic in some detail, it may be useful perhaps if we could have you tell us a little bit more about the circumstances and the details of this marriage of the Prophet to this lady.
Okay, I'll try my best, since we have only about 1 minute or so left, so I'll just get started on that and maybe
yes.
we can catch up with it. First of all, Umm Salama was also known by the name of Hind bint Abi Umayyah. She was one of the great Muslim women also. Umm Salama embraced Islam alongside with her husband. His name was Abdullah ibn Abd al-Asad. He was actually a relative to the Prophet. And because of the persecution, as indicated earlier, of those who became Muslims in the Mecca period, Umm Salama and her husband migrated also, were among those who migrated to Ethiopia. On the way, when initially they were going to migrate, they were stopped by the family of, by her own family, her own clan. And they said, how come? How do you want to go with your husband to Ethiopia? And they tried to prevent her. And then the family of her husband came and said, you cannot take your child because he is ours. We consider him to be theirs also.
Yes.
To the point that they dislocated the arm of the child, both of them were pulling him. And they forced her actually to stay behind for some time before she was able to join her husband in Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to leave the story there and perhaps pick up on it in our next program, because we've exhausted our time for today.
Sure.
We want to thank you all for watching and invite you back next week, and we'll have another program in Islam in Focus. Thank you for watching. As-salamu alaykum. Peace be unto you.